This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning. Welcome to AM. I'm Sabra Lane. Rescuers are combing through the smouldering debris of a Ukrainian shopping centre that's been hit by Russian missile strikes. At least 10 people are dead and 50 others are wounded after the attack in the central city of Kremenchuk. Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky claims there are about 1,000 civilians in the building and insists it posed no danger to the Russian army. The attack coincides with a meeting of G7 nations, with leaders vowing to impose further sanctions on Russia, as Europe correspondent Steve Kinnane reports.
As a fire rips through a shopping centre in Kremenchuk, paramedics scramble to try and treat those who somehow made it out. The flames and the smoke are thick and impenetrable, and rescuers face the almost impossible task of finding civilians who were inside this mall when Russian missiles struck. The city's mayor described the attack as another Russian war crime, a crime against humanity. Eyewitness Vadim Yudenko said that the mall was destroyed by the strikes.
I was not far away from the place where it happened, some 500 meters away. And people were running around. And after about 30 minutes, I decided to go and check out the place. The center was just destroyed. I'm out of words. I did not expect that something like this could happen in my town.
It could be days before the true number of casualties is known. This attack is likely to steal the West's response to what appears to be an escalation of attacks on Ukraine's civilian population. UN spokesperson Stefan Dujarric condemned the missile strikes.
We don't have any numbers on casualties yet, but it is deplorable, to say the least. Any sort of civilian infrastructure, which includes obviously shopping malls and civilians, should never, ever be targeted.
The missile strike came after the leaders of the G7 nations met in Germany and vowed to extend financial, military, humanitarian and diplomatic support to Ukraine and to stand with the country for as long as it takes to defeat Russia. UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson said that it was important that the West stayed the course with both support and with sanctions.
Just remember, it took the democracies in the middle of the last century a long time to recognise that they had to resist tyranny and aggression. It took them a long time. It was very expensive. But what it bought in the end, with the defeat of the dictators, particularly of the Nazi Germany, it brought decades and decades of stability, a world order that relied on a rules-based international system.
Tomorrow, the NATO summit will begin in Madrid, and already the alliance's Secretary General, Jens Stoltenberg, has promised a transformative meeting which will see NATO increase its number of troops on high alert from 40,000 to over 300,000. This is Steve Kinnane reporting for AM.
The Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, has arrived in Spain to attend that NATO summit, which has been described as the most important meeting of that organisation in decades. Leaders of the 30 NATO nation members have been joined by 25 other world leaders to discuss joint efforts to deal with Russia and its ongoing invasion of Ukraine. Our political editor, Andrew Probyn, is travelling with the Prime Minister, and he joined me a short time ago from Madrid. Andrew, Australia's not a NATO member. The Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, was invited to attend this meeting and is there. Why did he accept?
Well, Sabra, Australia's the biggest non-NATO contributor to the defence of Ukraine, from things like weapons to vehicles, humanitarian aid and protection visas. So that's a pretty good reason. But while Europe's feeling the heat from Vladimir Putin's invasion, perhaps the sharpest, the war in Ukraine has implications well beyond Europe. Parts of Africa are dependent on Ukrainian grain. The war has brought food shortages, the spectre of famine even, and Australians are feeling the war too, with higher fuel and energy prices. But strategically, Australia and other Indo-Pacific democracies are keen to pressure Russia so that President Xi Jinping, the Chinese president, isn't encouraged to act on his own territorial ambitions in Taiwan. Let's hear from Mr. Albanese.
The Russian invasion of Ukraine, of course, came in just after the arrangement was made of a special relationship between Russia and China. That reinforces the need for us to be engaged.
Andrew, just on that point, China is seeking closer relations with some of Australia's neighbours, including Solomon Islands. What developments are there on that front?
Well, on his way to Madrid, Anthony Albanese spoke with his Solomon's counterpart, Manasa Sogavare, who's had a really prickly relationship with Australian prime ministers, both blue and red. The Solomons has signed a security pact, as we all know, with Beijing, sparking fears that this could lead to China actually establishing a military base there, which would be a strategic disaster for Australia. But since the election of the Labor government last month, there's been a concerted effort to not only better understand what the Solomons needs, but also a gentle pushback against the Solomons getting any closer to Beijing. Mr. Albanese says he had a constructive conversation with Prime Minister Sogavare and says he'll meet him in Fiji very soon. Let's hear from him.
We both look forward to having a meeting during the Pacific Island Forum, one-on-one, as well as participating in that conference. And as well, Prime Minister Sogavare reconfirmed his position that Australia remains the security partner of choice, a statement that he made, of course, to Foreign Minister Wong.
That's the Prime Minister Anthony Albanese, and before him, our political editor, Andrew Probyn, in Madrid. Australia is undergoing a generational change with millennials catching up to baby boomers in numbers. It's just one of the fascinating changes to our national makeup revealed in the results from the latest census. Our reporter, Matt Bamford, has been taking a look. Matt, take us through some of the key ways that Australia's changing.
Well, Sabah, we're now a country of 25 million people. That's up by 2 million people since 2016 and a doubling of the population over the last 50 years. When it comes to different generations, millennials, so people aged between 25 and 39 years old, have caught up to baby boomers, people aged 55 to 74. They're now both the largest generations in Australia, with about 5.4 million people each. Now, overall, we're less religious. Almost 40% of us actually listed no religion. Christianity is still the most common religion listed by people, with over 40%. That's down, actually, from around 50% in 2016. We're also an increasingly diverse population, Sabra. Migrants, so people born overseas or who have at least one parent born overseas, now make up more than half the population. The top five reported ancestries in Australia were English, Australian, Irish, Scottish, and Chinese. In terms of birth countries for Australian residents, India is in third place behind Australia and England. Then it's China and New Zealand.
And what are the numbers showing about the makeup of our families and our health?
Well, Sabra, 46.5% of Australians over the age of 15 were in a registered marriage. More than 1.8 million people are divorced and over 600,000 are separated. And for the first time, Sabra, the census recorded more than a million one-parent families. Four out of five of those parents were female. 2021 is also the first time the census collected information on diagnosed long-term health conditions. The most reported conditions were mental health, arthritis, and asthma. More than three out of every five people aged over 65 have at least one long-term health condition, compared with one out of every five 15 to 34-year-olds. And females, Sabra, were more likely to report a long-term health condition than males. Interestingly, the final fun fact, Sabra, is that there are nearly 60,000 caravans currently in Australia. That's a more than 160% increase since 2016, perhaps related to COVID and people going for an outback holiday rather than an overseas trip during the pandemic.
Matt Bamford reporting there. Many parts of Australia, it's hard getting a timely appointment with a GP, especially if you live in a rural or regional area. And it's not just because of doctor shortages. Some still aren't seeing patients who have flu symptoms because of COVID infection fears. The federal government says it's putting more money into primary care to recruit more doctors and boost infrastructure, but will it be enough? Catherine Gregory reports.
Just 100 kilometres south of Sydney in Wollongong, it's common to wait a week or more to see a GP. And for this mum of two young boys, who we'll call Sarah, it's far too long.
So I had this horrendously sick child at home with me, unable to get a GP appointment. This was all via telehealth. And the fear that if I needed to escalate that, you know, he'd be sitting in a hospital room for ages.
Sarah's five-year-old has asthma, so when he got the flu recently, he was very sick for a month. She got a couple of telehealth appointments in that time, one even with a doctor in WA, but spent hours on the phone each day trying to get a face-to-face consult.
This is after 2 years of frustration trying to get medical appointments for my kids, and I just weeped big, fat, ugly tears down the phone to this poor receptionist who said she had no spots. And I said, well, when do you? How do I get one? I don't know what to do at this point.
Sarah's son was eventually seen, but a much-needed follow-up appointment still took another 10 days.
I don't blame the receptionist or the doctors, but the situation's just so broken. There's just not the GPs to service the people who need them.
The other challenge is that GPs often won't see children who have any sort of COVID symptom. Townsville GP Dr. Michael Clements is the chair of the Rural Faculty of the Royal Australian College of GPs.
We have changed the way that we do business when it comes to infectious diseases in general practice. Every practice has come up with its own way of managing that infectious risk, but people do need to understand in this post-COVID world, we will be putting in place protective measures.
But he says the main barrier to accessing care is a chronic shortage of GPs, particularly in regional and rural areas. And he argues that stems from the long-standing freeze on the Medicare rebate.
And it's a natural consequence of this holding back of federal funding through Medicare that leads to less and less doctors choosing to work in that field. It's a direct relation. So what we need to see is a reversing of that holding back in investment.
The Albanese government says it's investing in Medicare and primary health care to help recruit and retain GPs. Mark Butler is the Federal Health Minister.
Well, in the short term, over the next few months, I'll be convening a strengthening Medicare task force to determine priorities out of the primary care plan to deliver better general practice care for patients. We're also investing $220 million in GP infrastructure grants to allow practices to upgrade their practice, and also 50 urgent care clinics allowing general practice to take their practices to the next level.
And while he says he's also working to remove barriers on recruiting more overseas trained doctors who'll work specifically in the regions and outer suburbs, that too has its challenges.
We are competing in a very competitive global market for healthcare workers. And it's important, as we are doing that competition, to make sure that we are investing in general practice.
The Royal Australian College of GPs welcomes the Minister's promises, but says doctors and patients need to see action.
Catherine Gregory reporting. Just as many parts of the economy are suffering from the impacts of inflation, rising interest rates and supply chain disruptions, Australian agriculture is going from strength to strength. Farm production, exports and incomes are all tipped to rise this season despite some huge costs of production. Here's National Rural Reporter Clint Jasper.
In Victoria's Mallee region, grain grower Georgina Warne is busy spreading fertiliser on the first canola crop she's ever planted.
The price of canola was so high, I wanted to have a go at it.
And at $900 a tonne, it's enticed a lot of farmers to do the same. This year, they've planted the biggest national crop at 3.4 million hectares.
The prices are still wonderful, but our input costs are growing as exponentially as anything else.
Last year, Georgina Warne paid $750 a tonne for fertiliser. This year, it cost $1,300 a tonne. The big jumps in fertiliser and grain prices are both because of supply disruptions stemming from the war in Ukraine.
With urea at $1,300 and if wheat stays at $450, it's still over about it's over a 3.5 to 1 return on investment, which is what I have to keep reminding myself when I'm outlaying these huge costs for these huge inputs.
This season, farmers have to spend money to make money.
You cheeky chickens, come on.
Just west of Colac in southwest Victoria, dairy farmer Melanie Ackley has watched the bills for fuel, fertiliser and most importantly feed for her cattle shoot through the roof.
To think back 5 years ago to now, for an equivalent kind of dairy ration, we're probably looking at an increase of perhaps
100%. So, you know, from maybe $350 up to now heading towards kind of potentially $600.
But much like the situation facing Georgina Warne, the farmgate prices for milk are the best they've been in years. That's because the number of dairy farms has shrunk by around 20% over the last 5 years, and processors are having to compete for milk.
We're new to the industry. We've only been here for around 5 years. So for us, we're still in a growth phase and sending away a growing amount of milk, but that's not the case for the majority.
And with beef and sheep meat prices also sitting at historic high levels, the boom in the bush is spurring a huge investment on farms.
Definitely. The infrastructure that's been spent on farms is astronomical.
Hamilton-based livestock agent Heath Templeton has never seen anything like it.
Probably in my entire life, I'm 40, I haven't seen the infrastructure being put onto farms until the last 3 years. So a lot of people are putting new sheep yards in, they're putting new cattle yards in, their wool sheds are being upgraded.
While every year presents its unique challenges, this year these farmers are seeing more good than bad in the forecasts.
Clint Jasper reporting. Aid agencies are urging the international community not to forget Afghanistan after last week's earthquake, which killed more than 1,000 people. The mountainous terrain in the country's east means that getting aid to the disaster area is frustratingly a slow process. David Sparks has more.
In remote southeastern Afghanistan, teams of health workers are still battling difficult conditions to reach the hardest hit areas.
The terrain is very difficult, mountainous, and there are differences from location to location as well. For example, the Spera district of Khost, the terrain is so difficult, only very high power vehicles can go.
Dr. Mohammed Anwar Hanif from aid agency Care International is coordinating relief efforts from Kabul.
Our ambulances were stuck. We were not able to go in some areas. So the health providers need to go by walking and carry their medicines. There is also a fall of the communication system. The antenna, those things are destroyed. So communication is one of the challenge for aid workers as well. There is no appropriate accommodation where aid agency workers can stay during night.
It's estimated 350,000 people have been affected by the disaster, forced out of their collapsed homes and needing clean water, food, blankets and tents.
Progress is better now in comparison to first days because many agencies are providing support. So it is better, becoming better and better. But the thing is, the extent of the problem, the extent of the destruction, when you go deep to the villages, deep to the areas, you may find more and more things. So, for example, you planned for 1,000 family to provide tent, but when the assessment is going inside, it seems there is much more need.
Do you think there are still some villages that have not been reached yet by any aid or government agencies?
Many, especially in Gyan district, where is the highest destruction, as well as in many areas of the Barmal district as well, and Spera as well. Response is started, but still areas that are not supported.
In Australia, the Afghan community is doing what it can. Bilal Wahid is the executive director of the Australian branch of the not-for-profit Masood Foundation.
We have launched online donation campaign in the past few days and asked our friends and reached out to the community for support. So we as a grassroots organization, we understand how to deliver this aid to the remote areas in Afghanistan.
The Masood Foundation's office in Afghanistan was shut down by the Taliban when they returned to power last year. But it has partner organisations in the country and says that any money raised in Australia is funneled through legitimate aid agencies.
Because the community trusts us, so they donate for any crisis or disaster that hits Afghanistan, they reach out to us and they support and they help us. And situation like this, we definitely look for organizations that we trust and that we have worked with in the past, and we provide our support to them.
For now, many Afghans are being left on their own to deal with the aftermath of this disaster, while terrified there'll be another earthquake.
David Sparks reporting.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.